Well, it probably goes without saying, but I'm very glad to be here. My wife is with me, too, somewhere, and we're both glad to be here. I've always kind of wished you'd go to a meeting just once and the speaker read it up and say, "I'm sorry I came." I thought of how refreshing that would be. But I'm not sorry I came. I'm glad to be here. It's a pleasure and a joy to be with you and to see what's being done and to thank the Lord for the way He's blessed everybody. The life of David is our subject today. These notes were put together by me. We've been on the road a lot, and I hate to be apologetic. I hate preachers that are apologetic, but I fall into the rut so quickly because I did my typing on a small electric typewriter with no correction control. And I said to myself, if I can get through with no more than 5 mistakes per page, I'm a good typist, but you've got to understand how it goes. And so I did that. I sat in the apartment at Wilmington, and when we were down there ministering, and I would type, and then I'd see a glaring error, and I'd throw that one away. Wasted about 100 sheets of paper. But anyhow, this is the result. You'll find significant mistakes from time to time. You can correct them, and you can feel good about it. And one or two I'll have to point out because somehow I got a wrong Bible chapter in, or something like that. Anyway, I felt that I needed them, because if nothing else, they allow the people that are listening to take out a pencil and you can fill in the A's and O's. And people around you will think that you're taking notes and your reputation for spirituality will grow like crazy just on a basis like that. I also felt I needed them because they keep me on track and give me some idea of where I'm going. But our subject is the life of David, and I'll get working on those things in just a couple of minutes. But I want to tell you that David's life is an interesting life. The name David means beloved, or pleasant, or acceptable, or nice, or adorable. It covers all of those things. Not sure what did that. Anyhow, covers all of those things. And in the Song of Solomon, they just change the pointing a little bit, and the word becomes my beloved. So when you're reading the Song of Solomon, of course, you wouldn't say David, it's my beloved, but it's the same root word. And David indicates a beloved sort of circumstance and certain type of position before God. It's just an interesting way in which people are named. And some people study through the Old Testament a long time to see how the names fit the people. Sometimes they fit beautifully and sometimes you wonder about it. I still believe that Hebrew women named their children to a large extent like we Goyim people do today. You know, they just looked around and said, "What'll I call him?" And somebody said, "Call him Mephibosheth." And the mother said, "That sounds good." And that's how he got it. But I know that some were named because God gave them their names, and some were named because the people identified them that way. Anyhow, his name is David, and we are pretty happy with that. The history of David and the life of David occupies the scripture from 1 Samuel 13 all the way through 2 Samuel, all the way into 1 Kings 2:11. It also occupies the great bulk of 1 Chronicles. So he really accounts for about 3 whole books in the Bible. No one else in the Scripture has such an exhaustive description of his life and work as David does. And I don't know if that's why we're studying them today, or if the boys that put the program together just ran out of ideas. I don't know. But he takes up a lot of space in Scripture because his is the foundational ministry in the kingdom and the foundational work in the keeping of the covenants of God to his people back with Abraham and on down. I have to tell you that the brethren have been good enough to set a chair up here for me too because my feet are not good. My father, who has been gone a long time, my father gave me 3 or 4 great gifts. He gave me a love of Welsh humor and singing. And some people don't regard either one of them as a gift, but I do. I do. A great gift of Welsh humor and singing he gave me. He also gave me bad teeth. They were an inherited factor, so consequently people say, "Do you have your own teeth?" And I say, "Certainly I have my own teeth. I paid for them. They are certainly my own." Oh, thank you. But he also gave me bad feet. They're a genetic problem that show up when you live a certain age. Most of my male forebears died in their 50s, so they didn't live long enough to see the full details of it. And the orthopedist said, "Well, your dad must have had this kind of feet too." I don't know. He was gone a long time before he's my age. If you die at 50, you miss a lot of the problems of old age. Do you understand how that goes? But I'm thankful, see, but the feet mean that once in a while I get tired and I need to sit down. I don't like to do it. I like to stand because I'm an energetic fellow who likes to wave his arms and shake his ears and all that kind of stuff. But I sometimes have to sit down. And this fellow, what a very nice, you know, people were awfully nice to you. He said to me, well, don't feel bad about it, Tom. He said, remember Jesus sat and taught. That was a great consolation to me. I said to him, I was in an ungracious mood. I said, yes, and he went out and healed the sick and raised the dead. Yeah, he did a lot of things that I can't do. A lot of things. And he was a great teacher in any position. As soon as I sit down, I begin to feel lazy. Then I start to fall asleep. And the next thing you know, I'm like most of the people in the congregation. My eyes have rolled back, and I'm looking at the ceiling, and I'm wondering what has happened. But anyhow, I just want you to understand that's it. I'm not going to explain these things again. If I sit down, you'll understand that that's the circumstance of it. I'll try to stand up as much as I can because I like to, and this is a strong pulpit, and I can lean on it and do every and drizzle on it and all sorts of other things. It will take whatever comes. But the subject is not my complaints or my physical condition, but the life of David. And that's where we'll go right away, the life of David. I mentioned the meaning of his name. He's the adorable one. He's the wonderful one. He's the beloved one in Israel's history and the foundation of Israel's monarchy. I mentioned in my notes, and I'll stick pretty close to these things, pretty close. The rationale of the study is found in Romans 15:4, which if you haven't looked at lately, comes out this way. For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. That's the rationale. We study the history not just to learn and be wise about things, but from seeing what God has done, that we might be given patience and hope in what we're doing, and that our trust in God and our commitment to what He's doing is made the more real by it. You lose a great deal if you don't study these Old Testament accounts. All of them, I might say, from Genesis all the way through Malachi, you lose a great deal. And one of my learned friends once said, he said, I don't want to study the Old Testament till I've fully mastered the New Testament. If that's really your attitude, you will never study the Old Testament because you will never fully master the New Testament. You'll be lucky if you can master Philemon, let alone the whole of anything. So I get really nasty about it and say we need to study the whole Bible because the Old Testament is the Bible that Jesus used and to a large extent the Bible that Paul used. And the illustrations and the truth and the applications come from it in abundance. So we study the history of it. But I'll tell you what happens. History gets to be the dullest and most boring stuff in the world when all you do is look and see dates and names and places and who's who and what's what. History can kill you in about 3 hours. I have taught history for years, and I've seen them die. You can just list the names and the places and the dates. When we study the life of a man like David, we're looking to see the patience and comfort of Scripture that gives us hope. So we're concerned for the lessons, the life applications, the reality of what he was, what made him what he was. What we want to learn from him is not just that his name was David and that he came from the line of Jesse, but we want to learn how he was used of God and directed of God and blessed of God. And then we want to say, can we not trust God to the same extent and works and uses our lives? That's all the sort of thing that we want to work with in some degree of detail with regard to him and the circumstances about him. And I've discovered that church clocks never really work right. They run much too fast. So I always like to put my own out just because it proves to people that I have one. And when someone said, what does it mean when he puts out his sight? It doesn't mean anything. It means he's got one. That's what it means. Well, that's the rationale. Now, in our study on David's life today, we'll first of all do a pretty quick survey of David's life. Pretty quick because we have to move rapidly. And then when we're done with the survey of his life, we'll talk about some of the things that made him great. You may have questions that come up, and we kind of have an audience where I can't really interact with him very much. I always like audiences that are interactive, and most of the places where I am, they're very small, so you don't have any trouble interacting with them. But if you have some particular question, you could either check with me on the break, I don't mind talking at all, or you could write a note and hand it to Sam Thorpe or somebody else who looks like a person of importance in the conference. You judge the degree of their importance by their girth. You didn't know that? I'd be happy to take anything I could, and maybe at the my fourth hour and it winds down. If there are any questions that I can work publicly, I'll work them in at that time. But a quick survey of David's life is the thing that stands before us. Now, we're not so much interested in the facts, although we have to have them, as we are the application of what they mean and how they touch us in our work today. You'll discover that the concept of David's life, and a quick survey of it, really begins back in Genesis 12, the call of Abraham. Back in Genesis 12, with the call of Abraham. Abraham is the first Hebrew known to us, and he's identified that way in Genesis 14:13. Abraham the Hebrew. And some of the Egyptian literature talks about the Kapiru, the Hebrew peoples who wandered around Palestine and the Near East. So we know there were other Hebrews too. But Abraham is the first man in the Bible known as that. And in that sense, Abraham is the father of the Hebrew community, as well as eventually the father of the faithful. So actually you go back and see that God selected and worked through a line of people, really actually starting with Abraham in this practical covenantal sort of way. You discover that he ratified with Abraham a covenant, promising him a land and a country and a seed and a lot of other things. And that God renewed that through Jacob and Isaac right down into Joseph's day. In Genesis 49, you pick up the concept that out of Genesis 49, out of that family, would come the ruler or the leadership in Israel. And I've always liked that particular concept. I thought it was pretty necessary in the overall kind of thing. Because Jacob, in talking about what his children will do in the future and what their ministries and lives will be, points out that Judah will be the ruling family. He does it in a pretty emphatic fashion. That Judah would be the ruling family, and you kind of know that after that, they have to be a Judean in order to rule well. Judah, he says in Genesis 49:9, is a lion's whelp. And in verse 10 he says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. Shiloh is not the city, but it's a Hebrew put-together word for the one who owns the scepter. Until the one who owns it comes, and unto him shall the gathering or the obedience of the people be. David's line goes back to that. And then you discover that in Deuteronomy 17, not 18, I shan't read it, but in Deuteronomy 17, the Lord puts down the rules for how the king in Israel will behave himself when there is a king. It's always his plan that Israel would have a king. So he puts down the basic rules for that king in Deuteronomy 17, most of which rules have been ignored by most of the kings. But anyhow, the Lord prescribed what it would be, and he doesn't tell them when they will have a king, but he says, when you get into the land, you'll want a king, and when you want a king and get him, this is what he will do. And then in 1 Samuel 8, the David history comes real when Israel shouts for a king. They demand a king. They've had enough of the leadership of the judges, and they're particularly disappointed with Samuel's sons. Samuel is a great man, but his sons are not so hot. Or maybe they were too hot, but whatever the case is, they're not good. And the people are discouraged with the judgeship economy and the amphictyonic state in which Israel existed. They're bothered by it, and they say, give us a king. And the rationale for getting a king is that all the nations round about us have a king, give us a king. And God submits to that in 1 Samuel 8:22. Now I draw out these little lessons throughout my outline as much as I can. I miss some and probably manufacture some that nobody else thinks are good. But whatever the case is, the lesson you pick up quickly in the life of David is you don't rush God. I've used the word hassle. Not sure if that's understood in the South or not. You don't rush God. You don't rush God. God had in mind for them to have a king, and the king he has in mind is David, but David is a generation away. And Israel will not wait on God, they push God. And if you say, can God be pushed? Yes, yes, because of the nature and grace and goodness of God. He saw them in their wretched state, and he said in effect, you'll forgive me if this is too dramatic, but in effect he said, that's what they want, I'll give them a king. He will abuse them. He'll take their children and put them to work, and he'll take their sons and put them in the army. He'll make bakers out of their daughters. Oh, they could probably make Krispy Kremes. He will do all of those things, he says. And you'll suffer under him very much, but you want him and you'll get him. And they got him. Now, Saul was not totally bad, but he was about 80% ruinous for the country. And the country eventually suffered under Saul. And he would be rejected by God. And David, the rightful person that God intended all along, out of the line of Judah would come. Saul is a Benjamite, of course. And so I'm simply saying in my notes, you don't rush God. You don't push him. You don't say, Lord, I've got to have this or that. and that sort of thing. And if you wonder how people do that today, it's like a brother who spoke to me of his meeting, and he said, I'll give them 6 months, and if they're not growing evangelically in 6 months, I'm going somewhere else. I just kind of think guys like that ought to go somewhere else right away. And say, because you really can't tell God what he's got to do like that. You can't do it. You can't even tell people what he's going to do like that. When anyone talks to me like that, my wicked nature shows up. My obstreperous nature, which is very big, shows up, and I say, I'll show him. You know, have a bowling party on Sunday night instead of church. I wouldn't do that, really, but that wickedness, well, just shows up. So the concept is that David's life doesn't get, of course he wasn't born yet, but David's life begins in the program of God for a king. Then I mentioned the genealogies that help us to accredit David in a powerful way. And I actually, the first big genealogy is in 1 Chronicles 2, but this Ruth genealogy is important because it clears all the air with regard to any question of legitimacy or illegitimacy about David. The Ruth genealogy in Ruth chapter 4, after Ruth has married Boaz and things have gone on. I'm going to let you do this for yourself, I think, because I'm not good at these things. So you start at verse 18 down through verse 22. You'll find that David is the 10th generation, including the birth of Phares. Phares was an illegitimate child. And the law had prescribed that the illegitimate seed could not enter the family of Israel again for 10 generations. And just in case there was any question whether David, with that kind of parentage and, say, 10 generations, that's right. I don't try to explain it. You can read it in Deuteronomy 23, verse 2 and the verses that surround that. But just to make sure that everybody would know it, they spell them out, and you can look at them out, they count them, and you'll see that David is right at the right point for a return of his family into the full fellowship of the children of Israel. It doesn't mean that they couldn't know God. It meant that they were limited on their fellowship and access to the life of Israel. So the genealogy is given to settle that completely. Then in 1 Chronicles 2, you have the genealogy with regard to Jesse's family. I won't read that. I think you can pick it up on your own. And then that genealogy is increased in 1 Samuel 16 and 17, where it talks about Jesse's sons and David again. There is a problem in it. I can't undertake it much for you today. It's complicated, and I need an overhead projector and a blackboard and 15 excuses to go along with it. But there is a small problem there, and if you can figure it out, you can ask me between meetings, and I can tell you what it is. How's that? How's that for making the classes mysterious, don't you think? Don't you hate it when they make everything so plain that you can understand it right away and feel good about it? Better to have an air of mystery about it. But David is in there in the family of Jesse. And among other things, you'll want to note his sisters. You'll want to know his sisters in 1 Chronicles 2. You want to note his sisters because they become an important part of the whole narrative. His sisters are Zeruiah and Abigail. And the sons of Zeruiah, Abishai, Joab, and Asahel. You'll discover after a while, and I pounced on it, my note here says that they were ricker, but that's thicker. The word should be thicker under figure 3. Blood is thicker than water. Thicker than water. You'll discover that David takes more insolence and more abuse from Joab than anybody can possibly imagine. And I used to marvel at that. I'd be reading through the life of David, and Joab's a great warrior, but Joab did some enormously damaging things to the king. And I would be reading through it, and I'd say, why does David put up with that? Why does David put up that? And you know, suddenly you realize he's his nephew. That's why you put up with it. Blood is thicker than water. It may not be with you, but I've known a lot of people who took a hard line in biblical doctrine until some member of their family were affected adversely. And they can change their whole theology in one night when it's somebody close to them that's hurt. I'm not saying they're either right or wrong. I'm just telling you that's the way it goes. But you want to remember that Joab and Asahel, what's his name? That's what I call him when I can't slip right away. But they're David's nephews, and they're close to David. They're loyal to David, but they absolutely are unscrupled men. Loyalty to David is a great thing, but it should not override decency. And in the case of Joab in particular, it overrides decency rather easily. But they were David's family, and you'll see mention of some other persons with regard to David too. He has a little complication in the family in that one of his brothers is named Shimma, S-H-I-M-M-A, And then later on in Samuel, we read of a brother whose name is Shimeah, S-H-I-M-E-E-A-H. It's slightly different, and the commentators could not make up their mind if that's another brother or just another spelling of the first brother's name. And I have never resolved that completely, and I'm not going to try to do it now. I just know if you go back into Western Pennsylvania and you ask for Thomas V. Taylor, nobody will know who he was. Nobody will know who he was. And if you ask, well, no, Western Pennsylvania is too big. If you go back into one township in Butler County, where only 60 people live, but if you ask for, nobody will know who he was. If you say, where is Tom Taylor? They'll say, oh, he died years ago. So if you really want to find me, you have to say Tommy. You've got to say, is Tommy around? And they'll say, oh, yeah, he's somewhere. Reform school? I'm not sure, but he's somewhere. So it may be that Shema and Shimei are the same person. We don't know for sure. But that's David's family. David's early life occupies an enormous amount of Samuel, just an enormous amount. And I pick it up, see, in 1 Samuel 16, although actually you have to touch on 1 Samuel 13 to get the full flavor of it. You get the full flavor of it in 1 Samuel 13. You have to pick it up there. And that's where the circumstances are such that the Lord is telling Samuel to go out and find somebody to serve in his place. 1 Samuel 16. You'll discover that I want to look at a number of the scriptures fleetingly, and you'll discover that I have a thin page Bible, and they stick together, and I've got all kinds of excuses for not getting them separated apart. But in that particular concept, Samuel will have to go down and find somebody to take the place of the new king because of Saul's perversity. And in chapter 16, the person he goes to is the house of Jesse. To the house of Jesse, and there he will find the person that will be after God's own heart. And that's what the Lord tells us in verse 7 of 1 Samuel 16. He says, you'll go there and you'll find somebody in effect after the heart of God. When Jesse prays all these children in front of him, he says, isn't there anybody else? And Jesse said, yes. He said, the youngest one is out there feeding the sheep. We'll send and fetch him. He won't come down till he comes hither. He said, we won't get done till we see them all. And that's David. And we're told in verse 12 what a good-looking fellow he was. It's often estimated he's a small man because he couldn't wear Saul's armor. You have to remember that Saul was head and shoulders taller than any of the other Israelites. David, I think, was a perfectly normal-sized man, someone like myself. Perfectly normal-sized, probably with a little better muscles. I remember flexing my right arm to show my son my bicep one time, and he said, Dad, he said, I don't know if it's a bicep or a mosquito bite. But David is ruddy, looks good, beautiful countenance, godly look on, and I think a real man in every sense of the word. So Samuel will see him there, and Samuel will recognize that God's anointing is on him. And he will anoint him in verse 13. He will anoint him so that David will know it too. I don't know that David understood all the implications in 1 Samuel 13. See, if there's not enough problems in the text, we manufacture them. I don't know if he understood all of the implications or not. But I think that he understood them to some degree because he is willing to wait until he will come into the position God promises it. He says the Spirit of God came upon David from that day forward. So he knew something of the power and direction of God's Spirit working in him and leading him. And later on when he commits a great sin, he will say, take not thy Holy Spirit from me. He doesn't want to be abandoned like Saul will be abandoned in time. So his early life begins somewhere in the Bethlehem territory where he is and his father's taking care of the sheep and taking care of the flocks. In chapter 17, he gives us a little hint looking backwards when he's talking to Saul. And Saul doesn't think he's qualified to go out and fight. But David says in verse 34 of chapter 17, he says, when I was keeping my father's sheep, a lion, a bear came out, and they picked on me, and I just chased them off. And not only did he just chase them off, he went back and recovered what they had. He caught him by the beard. And the lion, he cut him and took the sheep that he was out of his mouth. David is no sissy, no wimp. He's bold and brave. And so he tells us a little bit about his path, that he's skilled in caring for the sheep, and that he will hazard his own life for the sake of the sheep. I don't know how far I've got talking about typology in David's life, because it's a complicated subject. But you have to see a point there. He will hazard his life for the sake of the sheep and for the care of his father's flock. He wasn't called upon to kill himself, but he would hazard his life by going into a situation where you don't mess with lions and bears. Believe me, you don't mess with them. We had an experience with bears in the Adirondack Mountains of New York several years ago. They showed up in our campground at night. And I was going to go out and chase them away, but the bear was sitting on a tent flap on the ground. And when I pushed it, it growled at me. I pushed it and went, ah. So I sat down to think about that for a couple of minutes. I detected it moved, so then I went outside and got a big boat oar and began trying to chase the bears. But someone said to me, they said, suppose that bear had turned around and walked in your tent. I'm not a Bible student for nothing. If he'd walked in my tent, I would have looked and said, she's my sister. Forgive me, gang. I'll try to stick to the published material. And I wouldn't have really said that because my wife is much tougher than I am. She'd have gotten grabbed that bear and whacked him a couple. And he'd have been glad to get out of there. But in 1 Samuel 16, we also pick up the concept of where David, as a young man, is brought to the attention of Saul to come and play music for him. Saul has this evil spirit. You notice it in verse 14, from the Lord. An evil spirit from the Lord. The Lord is afflicting his conscience for his disobedience and his wanton forgetfulness of what God wanted. And so he wants somebody that can play, a cunning player on a harp. And David is that. We don't know where David learned to play the harp. I've always thought it was a harmonica myself, but I've never had the courage to reinterpret the text. But whatever the case is, David comes and plays before him, and the music soothes him. Music does that if it's the right kind of music. Unfortunately today, most music I hear doesn't soothe you. It gives you a nervous breakdown. But he came and played and soothed him. And Saul sent messengers, 19, to Jesse and said, I want your son to stay with me. Your son took care of the sheep, and Jesse is willing to do that. He provides for him, and he sends David, his son, to be with Saul. And David is with Saul and plays for him, actually carried his armor at some degree. And then when the warfare with Philistines break out in chapter 17, David will be sent home. He will go home to work with his father and with the sheep because he's still relatively young. We don't know how old he was. But when we remember that he ruled 40 years and died at about 70, we think he was probably between 15 and 20 at the time, which in ancient times was amounted to manhood. But when you got these older brothers running around, cruising and holding down the territory, David would go back home, and he would be some months away from Saul. That brings us into the circumstance of the Goliath episode that comes on later. And I mention that in a very big way here because that's what everybody knows. If you say to people, what do you know about David? They almost always know two things, David and Bathsheba, and David and Goliath. They almost always know those things, and of course, serious Bible students know most else. But I've had many people say, well, I know about David and Bathsheba, and I would say, well, do you know how David treated his parents? And no idea how he treated his parents. Well, they don't get a whole chapter on that, and it's not nearly so grisly. But whatever the case, he treated them well. But whatever the case happens to be, David does a lot of interesting and remarkable things. But he gets ready to go back and see the battle, not to see it really, but to take food to his brothers in chapter 17. You must know the account. His father sends him back with provisions for them. Matthew Henry makes it sound like David could hardly make it. He makes the pack so heavy that David, when I got done reading Matthew Henry Terry's comment on it, I felt like crying for David. I think David had the assistance of servants and help in a cart. But whatever the case is, he takes food back for his brothers. He sees the battle. He hears the roaring of Goliath. And he's amazed that nobody has challenged him. He must have wondered why Saul didn't challenge him, because Saul is not nearly as big. But he's the biggest man Israel has. And David said, you know, isn't there a cause for me to stand up? His brother Eliab says, you're just a snoopy kid. Go home and watch the sheep. But David will stay there for the battle. Do you remember that? You know, older brothers often sneer at younger brothers. And I understand why. I've had a younger brother I've sneered at a lot. But whatever the case happens to be, David will stay. And he says, somebody ought to go out and fight him. I should go out and fight him. Saul says, well, when David tells him about fighting the lion and the bear, Saul thinks maybe he can do it. He suggests that David wear his armor. The text tells us that David couldn't wear his armor. He hadn't proved it. It certainly was probably too big for him, too. But he wasn't used to wearing armor. And he wasn't used to all of those things. He was used to fighting bears and lions, not Goliaths and Philistines. And of course, the concept is, if you can beat our champion, we'll quit and we'll be your champion. You better run for your lives. And so David gets permission to do it. Now, without elaborating on that too much, he goes down, takes his sling. He had an advantage right away, believe it or not. As far as we know, archaeologically, the Philistines did not use slings in combat. Now, you know, nobody can prove that. Nobody can prove that. We have data with regard to their fortresses and some of their artillery things and some pictures out of Egypt. But the assumption is that the Philistines didn't know sling warfare. And what you don't know sometimes can kill you. But that's an assumption. But I'll tell you what we do know. We know what the sling stones were like that were taken from Saul's palace at Gibeah about 50 years ago in the excavation. No, 60 years ago in the excavations of Gibeah. And in the corner in the armory at Saul's palace, they not only found a lot of slings, not slingshots, you know, but slings, but they found neatly packed a number of rows of stones, of slingshots, sling stones. I didn't find them. I just looked at them. And I'll tell you, they are about 2.5 inches thick. They're about 3.5 inches wide and beveled to an edge. I tell you, if a thing like that hit you, it would go through you, and you'd hardly even have time to bleed. Now, David picked up smooth stones from the brook. He didn't go and get sling stones. But you know, when you're a kid, you kind of think he picked up a pebble. Isn't it lucky he picked up a pebble? I tell you, he didn't pick up a pebble. He picked up 5 smooth stones. I would guess they probably weighed about 6 ounces apiece. Whipped it around. You know how it goes. He slung his hand, and the stone flew out, and the giant fell down. David fought him with a sling stone. The giant had the spear and the sword. You've got to get close to fight with a sword. And you have to get somewhat close to fight with a spear. You don't have to be right next to him because you can throw a spear. But spears that can be thrown can be dodged too, if you're quick. If you're quick, they can be dodged. And so the giant says, and David says, you come out with a spear and a sword, but I come out in the name of the Lord. Hey, sling stone. David knew exactly what he was doing. And someone said, why did he have 5? Well, you go later, I think there were 4 sons of the giants, and David carried lighter stones in case he needed them. I don't know. And I had a friend who kept trying to find a typology in the 5 stones. One was grace, one was faith, one was hope. I don't know about that either. I just know he picked up 5 smooth stones. And he only needed 1. He hit the giant in the head, knocked him down. They went over and cut off his head with his own sword, the giant sword. And later on, he would use that sword in battle himself after he gets it back from Ahimelech at a later time. The thing I make here is an important lesson. The person who has the trust of the Lord has the best equipment. You may not have the most guns, you may not have the biggest club, but if your trust is in the Lord, you can't be any better off than that. And you can put that in any language you want. It's an important thing to remember. And later on in Israel's history, the king of Israel will say, we can challenge the enemy and we can win whether there's many or few of us, because he who has God on his side has a big army. And one of my friends said, you know, he said, one with God is a majority. And to myself, I always smile and say, well, that's right, but God is a majority all by himself. You know, he doesn't even need that one. But it is nice to know if you're that one. I don't argue. You can split hairs the rest of your life. It's not my forte. Making snide comments is my forte. But I'll tell you, God knows what he's doing, and David was made well by that particular thing. There is a problem at the end of chapter 17 in a small way, because when David sees this boy, he acts like he doesn't have any idea who he was. He can hardly imagine who the particular individual was and what he does. And so he says to Abner in verse 55 of chapter 17, he says, whose son is this youth? And Abner says, I can't tell, king. And you say, if he sat in his court and played, and if he previously said to his father, let him stay here, well, here's what I think. I don't think he's saying, I don't know who he is. I think he's saying, where did this kid learn to fight? What kind of a soldier is his father? What kind of preparation has he had? What is he? And Abner will say, well, you know, he's the son of Jesse. And Jesse, yeah, but where did he learn to fight? That's what I think he's saying. And it's not that I don't know him. I never saw him before. He looks totally like a stranger to me. But previously, all he did was play the harp. And sing, maybe. And stand in the court and soothe the king. But suddenly, he's a mighty warrior. And the transition between the two jobs is not as automatic as you might think. So I think at the end of chapter 17, he's really saying, who is this person? Not what's his name, but who is he? Who really is he that he can get out here without his harp and kill the man that we all fear? You'll remember how the Philistines ran for their lives and Israel pursued them, and there was a great slaughter of Philistines at that time. So David is immediately moved, figure 4, into the court of Saul. In 1 Samuel 18, you have the touching thing, his friendship with Jonathan. That would be a long message in itself. Jonathan is sensitive to the leading of God. Jonathan knows almost immediately that David is going to succeed his father as king. Jonathan is never rebellious about it. He's never grudging about it. He treats David as a subject would treat the new king. And the relationship of David and Jonathan is a fascinating study in Old Testament history, and a fascinating study for how we ought to get along with one another too. I'll tell you, sometimes we get jealous of one another because of gifts and whatnot. That really almost becomes scandalous. But if we see the blessing of God and the control of God and the direction of God, then it becomes very easy for us to work with that. I went to a youth thing a good many years ago. After a while, everything was years ago. Have you noticed that? Yeah, years ago. Another man and I were speaking over about 360 kids at a Bible conference. I tell you, he had the genius personality. My, my. He played a little mandolin and walked around. He would have groups of kids singing. By 2 hours, everybody in the camp knew his name. If envy would turn you green, I would have been several shades. Because my personality is not that kind. It usually takes them 6 weeks before they learn to speak to me politely. I just watched this fellow. He just took over. He just took over. I don't mean in a bad. I mean in a good way. In a good way. I was just filled with admiration. That's right. I'm with envy. Tons of envy. And if I stood on the side and said, "Hey, two or three of you come over here and sing with me," they would have wondered what happened. But he would pull out this mandolin. He'd hit a couple notes every 30 kids, and they'd be singing "Hallelujah, Hallelujah," or something more spiritual. But they'd be singing anyhow. Anyhow. So on the last day of that conference, he and I sat together. We met every day to pray. You can pray with somebody even if you're jealous. Like J.B. said last night. He didn't exactly say it that way, but I picked it up. So I met with him to pray for this last day of the conference. And after we'd had a nice time of prayer, emotionally, I told him how much I admired the gifts God had given him and how thankful I was. I didn't tell him how jealous I was. And because he was the kind of guy, he took my hand and he said, "Tom," he said, "do you notice I don't teach any lessons?" He said, "I just lead him and warm him up." He said, "I'd give anything if I could give a Bible talk and they'd listen to it." I felt a little better. Just a little better. But I'll tell you, Jonathan is the epitome of somebody who says, "My will is bowed before the Lord, and I'm not even going to let my father, the court, or the promise of kingship interfere with it." He is a true, true, true friend, and he is that until he dies. And David will take an oath with him on two occasions in which he promises to spare him, and David will honor that oath through looking up Mephibosheth, his son, afterwards and caring for him as long as David lives and the circumstance. But you pick up the narrative in 1 Samuel 18. You discover in 1 Samuel 18 how Saul cheated David out of his wife. The promise was that whoever beat Goliath would be given Saul's daughter to marriage. And that daughter that he should have had from a technical sense is Merab. We don't know anything about her, but she was the daughter. But Saul was reluctant to give her to David. I can't tell you, he was reluctant to give her to David, but he does do an interesting thing that you'll note in verse 21 of 1 Samuel 18. He gives David Michal. Michal. That's another of his daughters. But he gives David Michal, and he says of her, she may be a snare to him. You get that? And Michal actually is a pretty good wife to him. But Saul says, I'm not going to give him Merab. That's the daughter he was entitled to. He says, I'm giving him Michal. She may be a snare to him. I don't know what he meant by that, but he must have meant something not good by it. But David doesn't get the reward that was properly his, and he should have learned at that particular time that Saul would cheat him out of just about anything he had at the same particular time. So it's an interesting kind of an aspect, I think, and I will not work on it much more than that. David's conduct is described to us in chapter 18 in several passages. The conduct of David is flawless. The concept is such that he behaves himself wisely. That's the text which is used repeatedly. And we learn from that that no matter what your position or what the authority is, to behave yourself wisely, meaning by that to walk in accord with truth and wisdom and with good common sense. Common sense is not so common, but we have to almost think it is and work along those lines. Well, I'm going to tell you a secret. Ready? We have a 10-minute break every hour on the hour. Now, I think their tapes go to 45 minutes, but we have to keep things orderly here, or I will soon forget where I am, and you'll be dead. So in about 10 seconds, it's 9 o'clock. We have a 10-minute break. You can eat a donut, talk to somebody, walk around, or take a nap so you'll be fresher for the next session. Whatever you need to do. But please, they'll ring a bell. Please be back at 10 after. I like to stop promptly, but brother, do I like to start promptly. So we will take a break at this time. Just enjoy yourself and try to be pleasant to one another.